Good evening, everyone. I'm Lina Ormoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the show today, we take a close look at malaria. And we start with an exclusive interview with Dr. David Reddy. He is CEO of Medicine for Malaria Venture, or MMV. MMV is one of the world's leading development partnerships in the field of anti-malarial drug research and development. For the past two decades, collaboration between Medicine for Malaria Venture and its partners have led to innovations and progress in the field of malaria, such as the development of 11 malaria medicines put into the field since 1999 and saving an estimated 2.2 million lives in malaria endemic countries since the launch of its first co-developed drug in 2009, and that's according to MMV. Here is my interview with Dr. David Reddy, CEO of Medicine for Malaria Venture. David Reddy, CEO of Medicine for Malaria Venture, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
It's been 20 years since the Medicine for Malaria Venture, or MMV, was launched. For the past 20 years, MMV has been working to provide treatment for malaria. How would you assess what has been accomplished so far?
Well, the Medicine for Malaria Venture is part of a bigger picture. And if you wind back the clock, if you like, to the turn of the century, around 1999, there were more than a million deaths a year from malaria. There was increasing drug resistance, and at that time there was diminishing pharmaceutical company investment. Really, it was a story of market failure. So MMV was put in place to kickstart, if you like, research and development for new malaria drugs to help try and solve this problem of resistance. And during that time, we've been able to build up, with a network of partners, what is now the biggest pipeline of anti-malaria drugs in history, including 11 that have been launched and are saving lives today. And along with the availability of bed nets for the prevention of malaria, this has saved around 7 million lives.
So more than 1 million deaths a year in 1999. Now we are at about 460,000 in 2019. Why are there still people that are dying if organizations such as yours are making progress in developing new tools?
That is a critical question, because the drugs today can save lives. So the issue that we're facing is that while significant progress has been made, a lot of people that need the drugs simply aren't getting them. And so what we're seeing is a picture emerge where enormous progress is being made in certain areas, but in others it's beginning to plateau. And we really need to work out how we can better push those drugs out into the corners, into the far reaches where the most vulnerable people exist. So today, one of the key barriers is one of access.
Access is a big problem. Okay, let's look at innovation in treatment over the years. Talk to us about the types of innovation that we've seen with MMV.
Well, there's been a shift towards using drugs in combination, so that when you take a pill, it contains actually two drugs. The benefit of this is that the drugs help, a combination of drugs, help prevent resistance, drug resistance. And so that's been a big advance. But one of the major and one of our first accomplishments, if you like, was to develop child-friendly formulations. Because when we entered the scene at the end of the 90s, there were around a million deaths, as I mentioned. Almost all of those were children less than 5 years of age, and yet none of the drugs that were being developed were suitable for children. And so our first job was to bring forward a combination treatment that could be taken by the youngest kids. Something that didn't require them to chew it, that was appropriately flavored, something that could be drank. And that was a product we developed with Novartis, which was a child-friendly formulation that's been given to hundreds of millions of children to date, and has saved multiple lives.
And there are a variety of treatments that are available for malaria, particularly artemisinin-based combination therapies. WHO says it is the most effective to treat malaria.
There's really two reasons why the ACTs are the best. The first is that the artemisinin component, these act really fast. And so you get rapid parasite kill and a rapid drop in the fever of the patient. It's generally combined with a longer-acting drug that, if you like, cleans up the remainder of the parasites in the patient's system. And so that combination has proved highly effective, but it also, because you have two drugs, as I mentioned, that helps delay resistance. And so it gives some longevity to this class of drugs. Although today, 20 years on, we're seeing the emergence of resistance to that class of drugs as well.
Absolutely. Recently, two new reports published in The Lancet reveal that malaria drugs are failing at an alarming rate in Southeast Asia, and there is concern that this drug resistance could spread around the globe. What is the extent of the problem?
So it's concerning because with these ACT treatments, we're seeing that the artemisinin that used to clear the patient very quickly, that's a much slower process. And the drugs that were in the combination that were trying to protect them, they are frankly failing outright now. And so the approach that's being used is to try and use multiple different ACTs in one environment. So you just keep the pressure on the parasite, but also in the region of Southeast Asia that you mentioned, to really pull out all stops to try and eliminate as rapidly as possible the parasites that are there, so you can prevent them spreading. At the same time, we have to realize that the parasite fights back, and resistance is, if you like, a biological inevitability. And therefore, we have to have the next generation of drugs available that will act against resistant parasites, and that's what keeps us going day after day.
And how much of a problem is drug resistance on the African continent?
Today, drug resistance to the ACT class is not a huge problem in the African continent. However, some of the older classes of drugs, particularly the ones that are used to protect vulnerable populations like young children and pregnant women, these are failing. And so we see a slightly different picture in Africa where, yes, we have viable treatments, but the drugs that have been used to protect those populations, they're reaching the end of their life. And so we need to replace those as quickly as possible.
There's something that I'm still a bit confused about, the use of quinine. What is the case of quinine if now ACT is the way to go?
So the situation is that in a lot of environments, there are drugs being used that still do not meet the WHO's guidance or quality standards. And so a way that this is being approached is to try and increase access to affordable versions of high-quality drugs that are recommended by the WHO, like the ACT class, or for severe malaria, like injectable artesanin. And so there are groups such as the Global Fund that procure these types of quality drugs to try and increase the availability, groups like Unitaid that put programs on the ground to try and ensure that these drugs reach the last mile, if you like. So we're working in very close collaboration and with funding from those groups and others as part of our own efforts and mm-hmm. also to support their efforts to ensure that these drugs begin to displace the inferior options that you spoke about.
Part of Medicine for Malaria Ventures portfolio focuses on delivering medicine that are efficacious and affordable. How available is artemisinin-based combination therapy in sub-Saharan Africa?
So we work with pharmaceutical partners, and they then do the manufacturing and supply. But when we enter into an agreement with them, part of that agreement ensures that they make the drug available in the malaria-endemic countries, and they make it affordable. And so what we do is we define affordability as being within an acceptable price range. So it's generally in the region of $1 to $2 for a full three-day course of treatment or a full curative treatment, if you like. At this price threshold, then the barrier to access is very low. And in addition to that, with funding of organizations like the Global Fund for AIDS, malaria, and TB, these drugs can be procured and then supplied to the countries. So through these approaches, both the way we work with partners, the strong focus on cost and price, and then the support of international organizations, this is helping ensure that the drugs get to the patients that need them.
Because there are critics that say that ACT is still a bit expensive for some people, especially those who need it in underdeveloped countries.
The price range is one that has allowed us to get into, and the drug, to some of the most economically deprived and some of the most difficult environments in the world. So at those prices, we are seeing the challenges are being overcome. I think the real challenge is that some of the low-quality, inferior, or even counterfeit drugs are being made available at extremely low costs, and it stands to reason because there's no quality assurance, and in some cases there may be actually no active substance in them. And so it requires not only pricing policies, but also legislation and strong regulation policies to ensure that that the inferior alternatives that aren't going to help and actually could harm a patient aren't being made available.
So, Mr. Reddy, when we talk about the challenges of access to treatment, you clearly explained that, you know, when it comes to cost, we talked about that. What else is an impediment?
It's a very good question. So some of the impediments in access, one, for example, is that there are some populations where there just simply isn't enough data available to support the use. And one population, for example, is pregnant women, where across the board, with most medicines in most countries, there simply is a lack of data. And because they're a particularly vulnerable and needy population in terms of malaria, the data needs to be generated. The other is that there are just environments which are difficult to reach geographically and from an infrastructure point of view, and that's when you need to get innovative. And we always think about innovation just in terms of our R&D activities, but we need to be thinking in terms of access. And I'll give you a very good example of how you can leverage things that are being used locally to really good effect. And that is in Zambia, there is a group we've been working with called TransAid, and they've been putting bicycle ambulances in place. And these ambulances, these bicycles, are used to take women who are having issues during pregnancy from the village to a treatment center, which may be many hours away. And this has successfully saved the lives of women and their offspring. We have a similar issue with children with severe malaria who may be in a coma. They're unable to take normal medicines, and therefore often these children unfortunately die. So with our partners, we've developed and made available suppositories that can be used in that type of children. And then they can be transported by the same bicycle ambulance system to a hospital that may be 6 or more hours away. One suppository will keep them alive until they can get onto an injectable therapy. And then ultimately, when they come out of a coma, when they're able to, they can take oral medication. And so this is just an example of how there are challenges locally. You need to understand the challenges, but then look to that local situation and say, how can we then use what they have available to solve this problem?
Now, you mentioned pregnant women. I know you said that over the years, one of the innovations has been to develop treatment that are especially catered to children. What about pregnant women?
Pregnant women, and I have to go beyond malaria here, there's been a fundamental philosophy in the development of any medicine, and that is that during the development, because of the potential harm to the fetus or to the pregnant woman, that they've been systematically excluded from all clinical studies and regarded as a vulnerable population. And the United States FDA and others are now beginning to change the way they think to say, well, the challenge is not excluding them from all studies, because that simply delays access to therapy ultimately. It's how can we safely include women into these types of studies? How can we collect safety information in a systematic and stepwise manner that will give us the confidence to enroll them so that ultimately they get the drug very early on? And this is part of the thinking that we have at the moment as well. And so there are some drugs where we do have enough information in a broad population that we've been able to now move in and start collecting safety information in pregnant women to establish that the drug can be used in that population. So we've turned it into a key strategic focus for our organization. The other element is that pregnancies will occur during the treatment of women, and so the collection of safety data on those pregnancies can actually inform how the drug could then intentionally be used in the future.
Idridi, thank you so much for joining us today and answering our questions.
Thank you very much.
And that was Dr. David Reddy, CEO of Medicines for Malaria Venture. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, today we take a close look at malaria. And now we will look at some of the efforts that are being made to eradicate malaria. This is a story by VOA's Henry Ridgewell.
Malaria kills around 435,000 people every year, most of them children. Significant progress has been made this century in fighting the disease, with the number of deaths dropping by half since 2000. The new report, published in the Lancet Medical Journal and written by 41 of the world's leading malaria experts, says the disease could be wiped out within a generation. But it won't be easy, says Professor Jake Baum of Imperial College London.
So, you know, you might think that actually right now we're kind of, that's the trajectory. The challenge is in the last couple of years, things have stagnated.
Just five African countries account for half of the global malaria burden. Burundi is in the grip of a malaria outbreak. Doctors say there's an urgent need for investment in healthcare. Dr. Albert Mbarane of the St. Assisi Anti-Malaria Centre says everyone should know that malaria is a disease of the poor, and in terms of national health policy, malaria remains the leading cause of death. The report authors estimate that $4.3 billion is spent globally on fighting malaria each year, but it says another $2 billion will be needed annually to wipe out the disease by 2050. It will also require new tools, which might include so-called gene drives that could make mosquito populations collapse or render them resistant to the malaria parasite. Again, Professor Jake Baum.
We need every piece of the jigsaw puzzle. So to say that just controlling vector would be the magic bullet, or just coming up with a new drug would be the magic bullet, I think most would agree that's naive. I think we need the new frontier of tools that maybe don't even exist yet.
A malaria eradication program was attempted in the 1950s, but abandoned a decade later. New focus and investment in recent decades, particularly from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, has given renewed impetus. But there are some concerns. Again, Professor Baum.
The last thing we want is to start saying we're marching towards eradication, but then you get that donor fatigue of stakeholder fatigue of we're just not getting there, we're just not making progress, this is failing.
The United Nations says better overall healthcare is critical. Dr. Pedro Alonso is the Global Malaria Director at the UN's Health Agency.
Without adequate healthcare, people-centered, properly financed systems, we will not achieve eradication.
The Lancet report authors say malaria eradication will require huge ambition and commitment. but the social rewards will be worth the investment. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Malaria is caused by mosquitoes, so are other diseases such as Zika and dengue. VOA's Lisa Schlein reports on an approach to make mosquitoes less dangerous to humans' health.
UN agencies say early next year, several countries will begin testing a nuclear technique that sterilizes male mosquitoes to control the spread of dengue, Zika, and chikungunya to humans. Guidance for testing countries has been developed by the Special Program for Research and Training in Tropical Diseases, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and the World Health Organization. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Texan 321. The World Health Organization says diseases transmitted by mosquitoes account for 17% of all infectious diseases globally. It says every year, more than 700,000 people die from diseases such as malaria, dengue, Zika, chikungunya, and yellow fever. The WHO says dengue has increased dramatically in recent years due to factors such as environmental changes, urban sprawl, and transportation and travel, putting half the world's population at risk of catching the diseases. Jeremy Bouvet is a medical entomologist at the Joint Food and Agriculture Organization and International Atomic Energy Agency. He says a novel technique that uses radiation to sterilize male mosquitoes offers new opportunities for controlling disease. He describes the sterile insect technique as a form of insect birth control.
You release sterile males that will outcompete the wild males in the field, and they will induce sterility in the female so that their eggs will not hatch, and so you will control the next generation. And if you do that for a long time enough, you will be able to reduce and even in some cases eliminate the target population.
The technique was developed in the late 1950s by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and has been successfully used to control insect pests from attacking crops and livestock, such as the Mediterranean fruit fly. A pilot program that will start early next year will be the first time the sterile insect technique will be tested targeting human diseases. The countries where the trials will take place will be announced next year, although a few likely candidates reportedly include the United States, France, and Brazil. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Let's now travel to South Sudan, where VOA's Pony Sheila, Sheila Pauline, looks at what is being done to address malaria.
In South Sudan, mosquito-borne malaria is the leading cause of sickness and death in children under 5 years old. Program Director for National Malaria Control Program, Harriet Akelo Pasquale, monitors the number of infections across the country.
This year, so far, we have seen that a number of counties have reported an increase above the normal of what they used to report in the past years. So from our weekly reports, 25 counties have been identified to report increase in malaria cases compared to the previous years.
As South Sudan enters the peak of this year's rainy season, the sound of their children crying from anti-malarian injections is something that mothers such as Faida Shamima are living through, but struggle to understand. Her daughter is only 9 months old.
I brought her to the hospital. Her body was weak. She was vomiting and having diarrhea, and I was told she has malaria. I really don't know what to do about this malaria. Even after treatment, it keeps coming back.
Pasquale says that the patient overload can overwhelm medical workers.
Annually, we see about 4 million cases reported from the health facility mainly.
Dr. Morbe Taban, the medical director at Al-Shabaab Hospital for Children, added 7 of every 10 cases they treat at the only children's hospital in South Sudan are malaria-related.
We have 12 to 14 medical doctors in the hospital. And I think we're now receiving 3 times more than our capacities. So we need more doctors, we need more human resource.
This year, heavy rain and poor infrastructure, filled swamps, flooded streets and overloaded channels creating ideal breathing conditions for mosquitoes. Sue O'Connor is the director of communication for MedAir. They provide medicine, treatment and treated mosquito nets to many rural parts of the country where malaria is on the rise.
So in our clinics, which we operate in a wheel, rank and lair, we are noticing an increase of cases in all of those locations, particularly in Aweil County. For instance, we had 797 cases reported in August of 2018. This year, August 2019, we had 1,300 cases. So it has increased this year over last year.
However, experts remain positive. They say with enough resources, commitment and political will, malaria-related illness and death can be reduced in South Sudan and perhaps even eliminated. Sheila Oponi for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
And once again, here is VOA's Henry Ridgewell with a look at malaria resistance.
The most effective drug used to treat malaria is becoming ineffective in parts of Southeast Asia, and unless rapid action is taken, it could lead to a global health emergency, warn scientists. Writing in the Lancet Journal, researchers from Thailand's Mahidol University and Britain's Oxford University say parasites that carry malaria are developing resistance to a key drug combination across multiple regions of Cambodia, Laos, Thailand and Vietnam. Henry Ridgewell reports. The report warns that the parasite Plasmodium falciparum, which causes the most lethal form of human malaria, is becoming resistant to the first choice drug, DHA piperaquine, in parts of Southeast Asia, with patients seeing a failure rate of 50% or more. The situation is so critical that scientists say the treatment should not be used in Cambodia, Vietnam and northeast Thailand because it is ineffective and contributes to increased malaria transmission. New treatments must be considered, says Sturgios Mostios of the University of Northumbria.
It might be opportune at this point in time to explore whether or not we should bring together different new classes of medications so that when the problem starts becoming more substantial, there is a solution, potentially, that works at the multi-drug level.
The report says urgent action is now needed to eliminate falciparum malaria from the region. Otherwise, the resistant strains of the parasite could further spread to other parts of Asia and Africa, potentially causing a global health emergency.
All it takes is a ship with infected individuals, or a pool of water where the mosquitoes are getting into Africa, and then slowly that parasite establishing a foothold. The likely scenario, however, will be that improvement of healthcare on a day-to-day basis in Africa will create the opportunity for the parasite to evolve resistance.
Currently, malaria vaccine trials are underway in several African countries. But drug combinations like DHA piperaquine remain vital in treating malaria, especially in countries with poor health systems. Since 2014, global progress against malaria has stalled. There were an estimated 219 million cases and 435,000 related deaths in 2017, most of them children under the age of five in sub-Saharan Africa. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guest, Dr. David Reddy, CEO of Medicine for Malaria Venture. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe Palca.